me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Jizz Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Jizz Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement, with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Diversity, equity, and inclusion are principles aimed at fostering fair and welcoming environments in workplaces, schools, and communities. Susan Stern is the George M. Jaffin Professor of Law and Social Responsibility at Columbia Law School and founding director of the Center for Institutional and Social Change. She focuses on advancing racial equity and institutional transformation in education, law, and culture. Stern collaborates with diverse organizations on leadership and systemic change, and she co-designs courses on lawyer leadership and access to justice for incarcerated individuals. She created the Center Change Skills Hub, an online platform for addressing race in legal institutions. A former VP and policy director for the Broadway Advocacy Coalition, she co-created Theater of Change, Reimagining Justice. She has received Columbia's Presidential Teaching Award and co-authored Who's Qualified with Lani Gutner. Today, we talk to Susan about her new book, What Might Be, Confronting Racism to Transform Our Institutions, which is published by Princeton University Press. Susan, welcome to our show.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
The honor is ours. So much to talk about during our time. But before we get started, tell us a little bit about your work and your journey. How did you get involved in this journey and this walk of yours?
Well, from the time I was in high school, I've always been interested in the situations involving people who were excluded and the institutions that set it up that way. I have had the opportunity to work with students and institutions that have been really struggling with these issues. And I have found that this is the most meaningful work that I've ever done, is to be able to work with people, students, leaders, community members, people directly impacted by incarceration, who are using their own experience, their own insights, their own wisdom to connect with others and to push for change. And I'm fortunate to be in a position where I can use the platform that Columbia Law School and the Center affords me to elevate the voices of the people who are really living these experiences on the ground and connect them with people who have expertise but that don't really know everything. And so to change the nature of that relationship.
Really is amazing having you, because there's so much to really unpack in so many different ways. But let's start talking about some of this, you know, paradoxics, right? You often relate to these and touch on these points, and we'll learn more when we discuss your book. But can you explain what they are when they inherit the anti-racism work? And why are they so crucial to understand?
Yeah. So every time I have worked with an organization or even with students, it's pretty common that people will start doing the work, they'll start making progress, and then something will happen and they will get stuck and they'll end up right back where they started from. You know, it's like Groundhog Day, the movie. And so really asking the question, what is it that keeps people and institutions who really care about trying to address people's experience of racism and institutions that don't allow people to fully participate? why is it so hard to make change, even when people want to, even when institutions say they're involved in trying to create full participation? And there are these contradictions that are just built into the work of trying to address race and racism in organizations. One of them is this paradox that I experienced writing the book, a paradox of racialized power. So people who are in positions of power in predominantly white institutions, many of whom are themselves white, have to step up to taking responsibility for the ways in which the institution might be excluding people or preventing people from fully participating. But if they do exercise that power, they might be pushing out the experiences of the people who have experienced that form of exclusion. And so people have to both step up and lean out of power. So that's the paradox of racialized power. I need to talk about my experience of addressing racism, of trying to address these problems as someone who has this expertise. But in doing so, I risk silencing the perspectives of the people who know firsthand what that experience is like. Then there's the paradox of racial salience. If we don't talk about race, if we don't name the ways in which race and racism continue to affect people's lives, continue to affect the way institutions operate, we cannot address a problem unless we can name it. We cannot take responsibility for a problem unless we acknowledge the history and the practices that continue to contribute to it. And if we don't acknowledge when race and racism are operating, we lose the trust of people who are directly affected by racism, whose participation is critical to being able to address these problems. But if we name racism, and if we talk only about racism, first of all, we might overlook other categories of exclusion that are also important, like gender, or like sexuality, or like disability. And if we talk only in terms of race, we might let people who don't identify with concerns about racism think that they don't have a role to play, that when their participation is absolutely crucial to being able to address these problems. So we have to talk about race and not talk about race. That's the paradox of racial salience. And then there's the paradox of racialized institutions. So we know that the justice system, the educational system, the police, you name the institution, that these are institutions that were formed at a time when racial discrimination and exclusion were lawful, and that continue to reflect and practice ways of doing work that exclude people based on race. So the very institutions that are responsible for addressing the problems we face are themselves practicing the things that they need to change. So the institutions that we have to rely on, like the court system, like the media, like our educational institutions, these institutions themselves have to be the target of efforts to make change. So this is the paradox of racialized institutions. And if we try to pick only one side of this paradox, as the Supreme Court is trying to insist on with its approach to affirmative action, we cannot talk about we can talk about, what we cannot take race into account in our selection decisions for higher education, we actually make race more relevant, more salient, more problematic. So we cannot pick one side of the paradox without triggering the other side of the paradox. We have to learn to hold both sides of these contradictory positions.
I hear you talking, girl. And for me, right here and right now, there is so much that you laid out already that let us understand the packs of little things that are like hidden in between this enormous, enormous field of different ways. When I listen to power, I think about always Dr. Elaine Penter-Hughes, who kind of said, you know, power is when I'm going to use it to impact others while benefiting myself. And what I enjoyed most about your response here is, and we didn't talk about it, and now we definitely can, is racism is not about this blackness and whiteness. That's just a tip of what people understand. So that's why having someone with your viewpoints and your expertise, you're coming from that salient side where you're able to say, look, I have been on the ground. I've also learned of biases that I may have had, but in the systems that we're talking about, we're never going to defeat it if we keep feeding into it. That is great stuff already to lead us off in understanding such a difficult topic. I want to also talk to you because I know that you have also have had to have your own challenges. And like early on, you've had to launch yourself against, you know, the institutional side. There are things that I want to get to understand. How do we address race and racism as a foundational category without leaving out the ways that they operate differently? Because I know when I was just mentioning race and racism, people, again, go back to the color scheme of how things are. Can you help us understand that?
It's such a good question and such a hard question. And it's right in the center of that paradox. Race is a foundational category because it was built into the Constitution as it was originally formulated. And until very recently in our history, was really structuring our relationships. And so many of our institutions, even if they are not intentionally or explicitly practicing racism, have inherited structures and practices that are premised on a set of values that were created without the participation and without concern for the impact on people of color. So racism is a fundamental way of organizing access to the things that matter most in our society. And even as we're trying to change that, even as we've made a commitment to changing that. But race is not the only category of identity that matters. And race itself is such a complex category. People who identify as having the same race come from very different backgrounds. They might come from different nationalities. They might have different genders. So it's a very complicated and complex category. And people don't only identify with their race. They also identify with many other aspects of identity. So how do you simultaneously take account of the complexity of race without losing what Kim Crenshaw refers to as intersectionality, without losing the involvement of people who experience also the same things that some of the same issues or challenges that people of color are experiencing that are built into the structure of institutions. And so one way that we can do that is to move back and forth from the experience that people of color have that teach us about what is it about our institutions that are enabling some people to thrive and others not. What is it about the way that we're set up? And let's understand how everyone is experiencing full participation in a system or in an organization or in a school. And then let's try to understand who's not thriving, who is not succeeding, who is not being given the opportunities or supported. And do we see any patterns around that? And can we understand what is it about the way we're set up that are affecting people differently? And invariably, in the world we're in, often you will see that race and racism emerges as one category of understanding of who is and who isn't thriving, who is and who isn't being attended to within an institution. But they're not the only category. And so when you start asking those questions, you can see the intersections between people who are experiencing the failure to enable people to learn in multiple ways. So they only learn in one way, even though there are multiple ways to learn. That is affecting many different people. My favorite example of this, or one example from this in my book, is when Freeman Hrabowski, who's the president of University of Maryland, Baltimore County, saw that Black students were not succeeding in science classes at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He asked the question, why is that? And it turns out that most students were not succeeding in science classes because science was being taught in a way that was intended to weed people out and that did not actually teach people to learn. And when you started to look at this, you realized that the problem was not with the people, the problem was with the way you were teaching. Mm-hmm. And so the teachers really started to rethink their mode of teaching in a way that not only benefited Black and Brown students, but actually benefited everyone in the institution and began a whole cultural transformation that made science something that many more people were interested in, many more people could succeed in. UMBC became one of the largest producers of Black PhDs in the country. And that started with thinking about race, as in my dear friend to whom my book is dedicated, Lonnie Guinier, would put it, the miner's canary. When we understand the experience that people of color are having in institutions that are toxic for human beings, we benefit everyone who is also experiencing those same toxic conditions.
I can tell you how difficult it is, whether elementary school or even middle school, to get kids, students, and even families to keep uplifting the work of Dr. Martin Luther King and other pioneers who kind of fought this from a different, you know, standpoint. But it's hard to believe that after all that's been done, parents are just so exhausted and tired that they're failing to support children in ways to keep the history rich. And that doesn't mean let's wait once a year for Black History Month to come up so we can have a celebration. It really means what you do, that I can imagine that you may come in to one of your meetings, and I'm not speaking for you, but you may come in there to one of the meetings and someone hits that chord for you. And now you're back in there because you now have to begin to break down the differences. And it doesn't matter what the counterparts are, could be a same race or different race. That kind of conversation is always going to stem reactions. And I think that you nailed it. And when a curriculum isn't well taught, it doesn't really speak to the people who are receiving it. We are very quick to jump into this data and not really understanding the ins and outs of what is really happening. I want to talk about your book, which I will have a link on my website. What might be confronting racism to transform our institutions? Now, at the very beginning of this book, just sipping through it, I was able to get an opportunity to kind of say to myself, there are going to be situations that are going to draw us to get into a bag, as we say where I'm from, when we have to fight back. You ask a simple question, say, hey, you know, I'm thinking about writing this book. Prominent person says to you, don't do that. Don't get yourself stirred in that kind of trouble. Please let us know. Start us off.
I think it's really, I feel like I'm right in that paradox, right? Should I, as a person who has not herself experienced racism in that way, should I be writing a book about racism? Should I be writing a book about transforming institutions by confronting race? You know, by some lights, that should be written by or talked about by the people who have that firsthand experience. And if I do that as someone who doesn't have that firsthand experience, am I going to basically just, in the word of this dean, just get myself into trouble? Mm. And, you know, the answer is probably yes, I will. And I have, in the course of my experience over the years, trying to teach to everyone in the class, thinking I am reaching everyone in the class, but I can only see with my own eyes. I can only see from my own point of view. And so I will invariably make a mistake or, you know, fail to include somebody in a way that I didn't even anticipate. And I get called on it. And is that something I want to avoid? Mm. And what I've realized in writing the book and in also in my experience over the years is that it's those mistakes, if I can lean into the fact that I am human, I will make these mistakes, I have these limitations, and I need to be able to learn from them and to stay committed and to take whatever I do know and see and bring that into the process, that is how I'm going to learn. That is how we are going to make change. And that is what is really needed, is the willingness to get involved and to do the messy work that has to happen anytime you're dealing with complicated issues of history and relationship and culture. You have to be willing to deal with the fact that there are no answers, that you're going to make mistakes, but that you can make progress, and that in the process you build relationships that are very meaningful, and that then with those relationships, especially multiracial collaborations, multi-positions, different points of view, social workers right in there with everybody else, that's how you can really make change, when you know that I have a role to play, but I don't have all the answers. And I have to change the way I think about my own power so that I can exercise the power I have, but in ways that also elevates the power of other people. And that's kind of what I've learned through both my research and also through teaching and experience working with organizations, and was the spirit that really led me to say, well, I might get myself in trouble, but as John Lewis said, that's good trouble. That's the kind of trouble we need to get into. And right now is a time when it's easy for me to say, so I say this with some caution, but especially those of us who are in relatively safe positions, we need to get into good trouble, because otherwise we're not going to have the community, the country, the democracy that we have so prized.
I am so glad that you did not listen, and that you're willing to get into the good trouble, because it is needed. And I'm going to say this in a way that people who have an opportunity should exercise it. And you have done that. And I think that your ability to touch your students reminded you of this. And that's when you said, you know what, I don't care what, I've done enough research. I think I've done enough. I've been in this game for a long time. I'm willing to do this for my students, because they can see things that sometimes I can't, just like you mentioned. And I think that, shout out to them for just lighting that fire into pushing you through. What are some of the things that someone, when they purchase your book, can say, wow, I wasn't expecting that from that viewpoint that you yourself said, look, these are some nuggets in here that I really want you to understand about this big, big topic.
I think one of the most important things that may or may not surprise people is that whatever position you have power to push for change. And that in this moment that we're in, when it seems like the forces are so much bigger than any of us, that we can't affect them, that we can, in fact, be change makers, that we can have an impact on the people around us, on our institutions. And if we find ways to connect across our different communities, our different organizations, that that is how we are going to rejuvenate trust in our institutions. That is how we're going to build change. We can't only rely on people who are in positions of formal power, whether it's the president of a university or the, dare I say, the principal of a school, or you know, a senator, or you know, someone who is the governor or at the top of our federal government, that we can't only rely on them, that the spaces where we're going to create the possibilities for the kind of change that has to happen is sometimes and often going to happen in these in-between spaces that we can build. So that's a really important thing, is like, find the power that we have, find the role that we can each play, and come together around roles that seem like they're working against each other. The dream weavers and the connectors have to work alongside the disruptors and the people who are really going to war, to fight for what we believe in. Like, both of those things are really needed, even though they seem to cut against each other. And so that's one really important thing that I hope people will take. Another thing I hope people will take is that don't try to come down on one side or another. Stay in that uncomfortable place of holding these contradictory positions, and find the people, whether it's you or other people, who can bridge these differences, who can hold together these tensions. And that's why conflict is not necessarily going to undercut our ability to work together. That conflict can, in fact, be the source of learning, can be the source of understanding what our linked fate actually is, which we can't get to unless we understand what's underneath that conflict. You know, find the people who want to work together in the face of those differences, and who come to that with mutual respect.
Sometimes we're drawn into things, and it's interesting because James Baldwin had three good friends, right? Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Eckers, and he loses three of them to the same type of form of ending. Yeah. And he saw conflict and had to react. Let's fast forward. We don't have that situation. We have tons of resources. We have allyships. There's different groups, and built in within your institution, you and others who have joined this movement, no matter where they're from, you are driving change based on what you have learned and put in practice through years and years of deep research. Hospitals have done the same as well, where they are understanding that we are only servicing certain amount of people, and we're looking for these type of operations to happen so that our hospital can function at a higher level. We'll continue to do things. But this is why I think you're so important to this game and to where we are. You continuously measure what you're doing based on the biggest mistakes that you can make, and you want to feel uncomfortable. And it's really an honor getting to meet you, because I think that that is one of the most powerful ways to really see things. Anyone who meets you can probably say, well, here's a person, she's an expert. And you're like, forget about all of that. I want to talk to you about the number of mistakes that I've made. And I'm going to apologize beforehand that I'm not going to get everything right. But I certainly know that there's something that I have to say, and I want to voice that opportunity. And because of that, I am here to tell my story. Thank you for that, Susan. I also wanted to ask, besides the challenge, it could have been personal ones, but what were some of the challenges for you in putting this piece together and getting this book to really come through? Because timing and work, how were things for you as far as challenges to get this message out?
Writing the book is one of the most difficult and also transformational experiences for me. Finding stories and really elevating the stories of the people who lived these complicated ideas. You know, so I'm an academic. I'm a law professor. I read a lot of theory. Sometimes the theory that's all about equality is completely inaccessible to the people it's about, right? So used to really being in situations where theory is doing a lot of work. So finding and telling these stories in ways that did justice to the people, that bring the reader into the story, you know, whether it's the story of Judge Fine, who's a judge in a Northeastern state court system, who thought he was doing justice day in and day out as a judge, a white judge. Most of his colleagues are white. Most of the people appearing before him, black or brown, sometimes in conditions that if he looked hard would say this is not acceptable, but were normalized for him. Mm. And who never really talked to the people who were not in his role as judge, except in very scripted ways that reinforced inequality. And who came to see that he was actually practicing something that did not fully deserve the name justice. Mm. And that was a process that he went through by being willing to look carefully, not only at his own practices, but as the practices of the institution itself, and also listening to judges of color, listening to interpreters, listening to court users, listening to people in communities who were experiencing justice, and then using that to rethink what he meant by expertise and how he was going to exercise his power. So one of the challenges is telling that story in a way that would be respectful to the person who went through that process. So I created a composite so that I would not reveal anyone's specific identity, but everything about that was true. Telling those stories in a way that would fully capture the possibility of transformation, the possibility of change, without making it seem like we've solved things, because we haven't. Everything we do is a step, but it's a step in a direction, in an ongoing process that's something there's no silver bullet for. I can't give you a formula, say you do these five things and it will be fixed. So how do we create enough of a sense of possibility that is real, that's based in what really happens, that people will do the work of making the change without thinking that it's one and done? Now I've done it. I've checked the box. Now I can go back to business as usual. The work of transformation has to be business as usual. And that's a hard thing to convey in a way that people will want to do, in a way that will invite people to say, yes, I can do this. I can see myself in the people who I describe in the book. I can see myself doing these things. And that's what I'm hoping for with the book, is that it will bring some of the most cutting edge ideas to people from different disciplines, but it will be done through the voices of people who have really struggled, sometimes more successfully than others, to push for this kind of change in their own workplaces, in their own communities, in their own school systems.
I love that frame, and that even though someone who has a title or has what seems like a position of power, they too struggle with this, and yes, even sometimes harder than some of the people that we think, when we hear struggling and suffering, we want to associate that with someone who's not doing well or has dealt with it because they were incarcerated. No, people who have high level functioning jobs struggle just as much. I want to talk a little bit about how does the paradox of racialized institution challenge traditional diversity, equity, and inclusion in their efforts?
Racialized, if an institution has practices that originated in a racialized society with a racialized history, are now kind of built into the culture of the institution, it can be very difficult to see them. It's like, you know, the fish don't see the water they're swimming in, mm-hmm. right? You're in it. You just take it for granted. And I think that's part of what happens in institutions that are no longer overtly practicing racism, but have a kind of culture that normalizes a set of practices that are exclusionary. How do you understand those really deep structural challenges through the lens of what's often one training program or a one-off exercise? You cannot transform practices that are unfair and not working for lots of people by simply inviting people into a workshop, or putting all of the responsibility for doing this on one person who then doesn't have any of the resources that they need to actually be able to make those kinds of changes. So this is part of the challenge, is that the institution might not even see the ways in which we can learn about how the institution is not functioning fairly or well for anyone by understanding the impact of that institution on the people who are suffering the most. But the institution has to be willing to engage in that kind of inquiry, in that kind of institutional mindfulness, to be able to see that. And that is practicing a kind of full participation that goes deeper than a single training program, that goes deeper than a single official whose position it is to hold the responsibility for in the entire institution. So it takes some kind of often pressure from somewhere, or a group of people who come together and have the support of people in leadership, as happened in many of the organizations that I've worked in, where they say, wait a minute, there's an issue here that's not only about race, that's not only about gender. It's really about how we've defined and pursued the values that are most important to our institution, and willing to ask some questions that not only make it possible for everyone to participate more fully, but increase the relevance of the institution. A law journal that I worked with had this experience of trying to understand why it was that more people of color and women and first generation students were not participating, and discovered that there were ways that they were working that made the law review not relevant to readers and not interesting to students. And they began to change their orientation in a way that really helped everybody think differently. That is a much more fulsome idea of full participation that is what makes it possible in this environment to continue to address issues of race. And I would just say, we can't not address race if we care about full participation. We can't not address full participation if we care about democracy.
I truly like how you kind of, right in your answer, were able to let us see when a leader is dealing with this, and oftentimes they have to deal with it to some degree, you know, how do I stay true when I see things that this anti-racism commitment that I have now is backtracking? How can I do that? I love how you teased that out and were able to say, listen, this has to be looked after in different ways, but it's not going to be on one person. I really, truly understand that now we have made positive gains, at least in my eyes. I usually have seen meetings that people are more mindful of what they say and how they say it. And it doesn't even sound anymore as if they're being disrespectful or that I feel oppressed with the way that they're saying it. There is so much to learn from that. But I think that we are moving towards what you said earlier, that it's probably not a one and done. It's a, you know, 365 kind of 24 hour kind of commitment that we need to have in this to really pour.
Could I just say that it's so good to hear you say this, It's really important to hear you say that we are moving. You are someone who is working in a school, in a community, which is a very one of the most important institutions in our democracy is our schools that are really creating the pathway for our future. And for you to say that you're seeing that shift is so important because I think there are so many people who are feeling discouraged, who are feeling hopeless right now. And we can forget that there are institutions where that change has taken root and it can't be uprooted from 1 minute to the next because it's not located in only one person. It sounds like it's been built more into the way you work in your institution. And that is something that can't just be eliminated. That is now built into your way of doing things. And I think that's what we need to push for. We need to push for ways of working day in and day out and policies that support those ways of working, that support the humanity of everyone, that meet people where they are, and that can face up to the ways in which we are not currently treating people as full participants for whatever reason, including race.
I can tell you, even when you're having these, meetings with families, I often have pushed, even before becoming a school leader, that I needed to know that the parents were team members. And that took me some time, Susan, so that it can be understood. Because if it didn't feel right, I would go back to reiterating what that sounds like. Just because, English is not my first language does not necessarily mean I'm not here to support my child. I may need a translator, but I'm struggling to really understand what is happening, and I am here, and me being here should be step one in me wanting to see change. And just because I have a table full of experts who've went to school for specific things, they may be able to point me in the right direction. Helping me is that right way. And I think that that's why your work is required, needed, and will be something to reckon with, because I feel that your driving force in making change really stems from something that is passionate, not some big audacious goal that you're worried about. It just makes my resume look a lot better. This is really about you dealing with real situations that you are sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Well, one of the things that you just said that was so powerful, and that is actually the focus of one of the chapters in the book, is it sounds to me like when you're meeting with parents who, for whom English is not the first language, and who might not themselves have a college degree, but who know their children and have become very adaptive and are committed to their children, that they have a kind of expertise that you value, and that you had to rethink the way power was being exercised in your interactions with those parents and rethink the way you're thinking about expertise, that it's not all your expertise, that you bring different expertise into a shared goal of supporting your students. And that is repurposing power. What you're describing, that's the title of one of the chapters of my book, is repurposing power so that people can contribute what they have to contribute, so that people who are directly affected and most interested have a say in what's affecting them. And people like us, I have something to contribute. I shouldn't step back and say, I don't know anything, or because I didn't experience this, I shouldn't have a voice. But I have to accept what I know and also what I don't know. So we're defining expertise in a much more heterogeneous way so that we can all come together and contribute by sharing the power to solve problems. Rather than saying, you tell me what your problem is, I'm the expert, I'll tell you how to fix it. That's not going to work. It's not going to work for the kind of complex problems that we have. And there are some great examples of this also described in the book that that are really another version of your story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In these stories that you were able to, I don't know how to transform into, I know that you became enmeshed with these stories, so they really touched you personally. And I know you had to do some deep reflection and thinking after going in here and learning about, oh my God, this is truly not happened, but I just heard it. I have to take account. Is there a story for you that sticks out more than others? I know there's so many within your book. Is there a story that really reminds you to say, you know what, Susan, I'm not going to give up on this. I have to think about this situation, and I am here to fight that. Is there such a story for you that you can share for us?
Well, let me tell the story of Alejo Rodriguez, who is become a very close collaborator, someone who is a brilliant man, a poet, a scholar, and did 32 years in prison. And I have been working for many years with law students who get very discouraged about the law, but who also think that they're the ones who are going to have to solve these problems. They're right in the midst of that paradox. I came to law school to practice social justice, but law is so unjust. What can I do? I'm losing contact with my communities. And this is true of students of color, first generation students, white students who come really across the board. And so what happened? I started working, instead of working only to tell stories for people, I started working shoulder to shoulder with people like Alejo and with Alejo. And he came to my class along with two other people who had also experienced incarceration. And he talked about not only his experience of the system and way that the system had continuously treated him like someone who didn't matter. And that started in elementary school. But he also had a very deep analysis of how policy was really creating situations where people who cared were stuck in their silos. The lawyers who were working to address these issues were stuck in these positions that were just reinforcing the kind of distrust that made it impossible for these collaborations to happen. And I watched something happen when Alejo and was able to bring this knowledge to my students in a way that not only reflected his own experience, but showed his deep understanding of these systems, showed what was missing from constitutional law, from all of the other courses that they had taken that helped explain why we are stuck. And in that moment, transformation happened that then has had a profound impact on not only what these students are doing, but on what we were able to then create in the law school. And we are now, for example, rewriting the Jailhouse Lawyer's Manual published by the Columbia Human Rights Law Review and the Jailhouse Lawyer's Manual, with every chapter being co-authored by someone who has experienced incarceration. And for the first time, that book is really becoming accessible. That could not happen until we put our different kinds of expertise together and learn with and from each other. And this has been the most moving experience for so many people who want to become criminal defense lawyers or prosecutors or governors or teachers. And so that to me was an example of transformation that came from taking someone who I call an organizational catalyst. He has a PhD in the streets and a master's from Union Theological Seminary, who can speak multiple languages and help forge connections across these paradoxes. That's how change happens. And now it's building and building and building, but we had to start somewhere.
Such a lovely story. and one that should encourage my listeners to remember, no matter what the circumstances are, there's going to be opportunities. And these are the ways that I believe transformation is built. Can you share with us some of the strategies that are in your book that can help us build authentic partnerships between, let's say, an institution of power and one that's without power?
Yeah. This idea of humility that you picked up on early on is a really important starting point, learning to live with the fact that this is a complex and contradictory problem, and that no institution and no person has a solution. So we have to get comfortable with that. And that is actually hard to do. It means maybe expanding our definitions of success, not measuring success on a quarterly system and achieving the ultimate outcome, but thinking about how we are moving toward our goal, who is being able to participate in shaping our goal, how we are reflecting and learning about the process, as well as our more numerical outcomes. So that's one step that's really important, learning to live with complexity and to measure ourselves, but not in ways that are going to cut off the kind of long-term struggle that change requires. So that's one really important thing. Another really important thing is to reframe what we're thinking about, whether it's racism or education, in terms of our linked fate. How is it that institutions that have resources, that have power, that have prestige, why is our fate linked with institutions that may not be, in the words of Fisk, which is a historically Black college university, in the words of Fisk, Vanderbilt is resource rich, but Fisk is resourceful. Mm. I love that.
Mm.
And so the kinds of strategies for learning, for dealing with the most complex problems, for building trust, for understanding the ways in which our institutions are failing, for being able to reach the people who need to be able to become our leaders and are currently being left out of communities, that's what institutions that don't have prestige and power in the sense that we often overvalue, that's what they bring to the table. So really building partnerships between resource-rich and resource-full institutions, the way Fisk and Vanderbilt did in a partnership that is now building pathways for students to go into PhD programs from Fisk into Vanderbilt, which has had a very hard time reaching communities into communities of color that are so important to include in the educational arena. So we have to learn how to share and how to share in ways that really reshape the way power is exercised. And that happens by thinking about these ways in which we have this linked fate.
Mm.
And that can really make a big difference. And that also allows us to build these multiracial collaborations that have become, for me, the most meaningful and, I would say, educational experiences that I have had, is when I get to interact with people that come from all different backgrounds and who I can learn from, even as I am sharing what I have in the way of knowledge. And so building those joyful and struggling multiracial collaborations and making them micro spaces of justice and of fairness and of full participation, so they become the thing we then build on, so that we build on those little, what Adrienne Marie Brown calls fractals, these mm-hmm. little spaces that you try to replicate over and over and over again, that in a small way have, this is the world we want. Now, how do we make it bigger?
Mm. You know what? I would be remiss if I wouldn't bring in your partner in crime into this situation. Before we let you go, the floor is yours. I want you to talk to your girl, Lonnie Gutner, right now, and just tell her, now that you got this book, I know that she's worked with you before, and I know what she means to you. Send us off with a message to her, because I know she's going to listen to this, and I want to make sure that we lift her up because she means so much to you. Tell her something right now.
Well, if she's listening, it's listening from the other world, because Lonnie Guinier died a couple of years ago. It was a huge loss to so many people because she was a combination of a racial justice warrior and a racial, multiracial builder of communities and collaboration. And what I want to say to her beautiful son, Nico, who's now following in her footsteps. She was on the faculty of Harvard Law School. He is now on the faculty of Harvard Law School and practicing, really creating environments that enable everyone to learn and thrive and become more just lawyers, while he's also attending to the needs and concerns of students of color. I would say, Lonnie, your work that talks about the miner's canary, your work that talks about building multiracial communities, your work that says that people of all different races can care about and take steps to learn about how we can make more democratic and just institutions by attending to the concerns of the people who have been most excluded, that your work lives on, that we will use your work, not just me, but all of the people that Lonnie has touched, many of whom I've referred to in the book, you know, Gerald Torres and Marshall Ganz and so many other people that you are living through us, that your legacy lives on, and that we will not quit. We will not quit. You never did, and we never will.
Beautifully said. And I know that she's with you. A great friend of mine, Melody Kraft, who is deep in spirituality, always says, we're here on borrowed time. It's what you and your friend are going to continue to do from all over the places that you will still venture with her. Such a lovely ending to our show. And really, Susan, it was such a pleasure having you. And it's really amazing to hear how beautiful it is to understand that mistakes are always going to be made. And you welcome that. You bring that sense of family and joy, and that is such a beautiful thing. You know, fear is part of the process of our achievements, but your achievements will now be the fears of others who doubt you. And that is what I call trust in the process. Because on this platform, it was built, because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer our plight and our fight. Is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Susan, thank you so much for such an amazing show. Blessings to you.
Thank you so much. I really love speaking with you.
Such a pleasure. This book is going to be a smash, my friend. I can't wait to hear the details.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa. This is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde De La Rosa. Esto va dedicado a ti, Mamá. Te extraño mucho.